Okay. Kai, why don't we start with a sound check here? So, how about first name, last name?
Kai Urabana.
Thank you, Kai. So, this is Troy Reeves. I'm here with Kai Urabana. And today is September 15th, 2015. This is, I think, our fourth interview about the Capitol protests, the uprising. And I think, and I'm with the UW Mass Oral History Program. All right, Kaya, we were basically just going to pick up where we left off. Why don't we just start there and go from there?
Okay. So we left off in the early part of the uprising. I was talking about the different kind of hubs, I think, at the end of our last interview. And I had mentioned that I had looked back, there were a few diaries, blog posts that I put up on Daily Kos, and I mentioned, I think I mentioned those, I'm not sure I mentioned what my username actually was, just on the off chance that anybody cares. It's Lilbird, so L-I-L, and then a space and bird. And I also dug up my old, I'm really old-fashioned in certain ways, and carry around these, like, paper planners, so I have the one that my 2011 planner, I dug that up, and that helps a little bit in kind of jogging my memory. Although I certainly didn't write down everything in it, because there was just too much chaos in the Capitol to have it all in a planner. It wouldn't have fit in there anyway, I'm sure, but some things I have down there. So I did my best to kind of put things in order, although certainly there were some things I couldn't really place. The early part of the occupation, I was mostly in the Capitol those days, but I was coming and going to do some interviews for my PA ship. And I also, during the first, not even sure if it was the first week or the first bit anyway, I was going home on a pretty much a daily basis to shower. So I would go home, I'd shower, I'd do whatever other thing I would need to do, finger things like interviews, and then I was pretty much at the Capitol all the rest of the time that I didn't really have to be somewhere else or I wasn't like showering, changing clothes. and obviously later on that luxury of showering went away. So I didn't do that, but I mean, I did it while I could go in and out of the Capitol freely. I think I had mentioned that I was organizing, like one thing I was doing early on then was trying to make sure everybody who was staying overnight, or as many people as possible anyway, had basic civil disobedience training, legal rights training, knew what to do in case there was a crackdown and everybody was rounded up and, you know, arrested. So I was doing what I could there. and also part of that was coordinating people to go around and collect people's contact and basic information before bedding down for the night. So basically for jail support type stuff. So in those early days also, there was, I think there was a lot of discussion, a lot of, I remember quite a bit of discussion about how the focus had been or was, like the media focus was more on the collective bargaining aspect than it should be, although that was obviously really important. But there were quite a number of other bad things in there, and a good number of the people who were regulars in the Capitol felt like we needed to figure out ways to shift some of the discussion, you know, onto the rest of the bad stuff in there. And hence the chant, kill the bill, and you know, the idea was we should get rid of this whole bill because the whole thing is toxic. It's not only the stuff having to do with unions, although obviously that's bad enough. So I remember in those days quite a few discussions along those lines with different groups of people or different people in the Capitol and outside the Capitol and what have you. So we were kind of concerned about, like, there was an awareness of what the media coverage was looking like, even though a number of us didn't have a whole lot of time to really follow it in depth, and that was definitely me, but at least some awareness of what was being discussed, about Wisconsin, outside of Wisconsin, and within Wisconsin. There were also a lot of outside rallies, of course, which I typically would leave the Capitol to attend, because, again, you could come and go at that point. You weren't prevented from re-entering if you left. I also remember how just massive and inspirational they were after the first couple of days, especially when I started to feel hopeful. They were also really peaceful in general, and that was something that at the time I felt really I guess, proud of. Not super surprised, but just surprised a little bit that there weren't, like, provocateurs, at least, in the crowd, like, trying to, you know, creating problems and trying to get people riled up and doing things that were illegal and that sort of thing. And I was surprised about that, of course, on that prank phone call that Walker had with, theoretically, with David Koch. I forget the guy's name that actually was on the other end of the line. But something along, some kind of, something came up on that call about, well, have you thought about, and I'm totally paraphrasing because I don't remember the detail, but, you know, have you thought about putting people out there to kind of basically be provocateurs? And he said, nah, I didn't think it was necessary or something like that. But it was pretty amazing because a lot of protests, you will have these individuals who may kind of look like protesters. Maybe they will, more or less. I mean, some of them are pretty convincing, but sometimes not so much, who will end up stirring up, you know, trying to stir up violent behavior and that kind of thing. And the fact that we really didn't have that was surprising in a way. But also the people who were real protesters, which was basically everybody as far as I could tell, were really peaceful. And there was this real sense of community and of not wanting to do things that would be perceived as not friendly or that would be violent in any way or would run that risk. So people, I think, kind of kept an eye on each other, too. I mean, we had a few individuals, certainly, who would get a little overly excited and maybe start, you know, wanting to badmouth the Fox News camera or something like that. And other people would kind of pull them back and say, no, you know, let's not have this conversation in front of the camera kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So I really feel like there was this, just this interesting kind of sense of community and of a collective cause and wanting to, you know, make sure we were all putting the face forward that we would want, which is what we were, which was peaceful protesters there for a good reason, not just, you know, kind of some riffraff instigators or whatever. And of course, there was all kinds of creativity on display in the signs, a lot of humor. I don't remember when that Fox News story was that had the footage with palm trees in the background of, like, violent protesters with palm trees. And you probably know it's probably on this timeline, but I don't remember. But I really appreciated all the palm tree imagery after that. I think we all did, where the palm trees, like the inflatable palm trees and handmade palm tree signs and palm tree t-shirts started all showing up. And, you know, that was definitely a bit of levity in this time. And of course the high school students, I don't know if it was Tuesday or Wednesday that first week, but when there was a big group of high school students from, I think, a few different high schools that walked out, I just remember seeing them coming down the cat, like the, I forget which of the, it's the side of the Capitol, it doesn't matter, but the side of the Capitol Square that's by Grace Episcopal, I think, like by West Wash. I just remember them coming, like seeing them come around there, like in this block with this American flag and just feeling really grateful and inspired by, you know, them coming out. Because, of course, this bill wasn't something that was going to be affecting them, well, directly anyway. I mean, obviously they're teachers, but they were there in solidarity. And that was really amazing just to see these young people out there doing this. And they'd walked basically from school, which was several miles for some of them. So it was very inspirational. In terms of inside the Capitol, I was doing my best to carry on my ongoing kind of business from within there. I mean, I wasn't teaching a class like some people, or TAing a class like some people were. And the interviews I was doing for my PA-ship were, for the most part, things I would have to leave the Capitol to go do. But I was doing what I could, most of which was organizing type stuff, from within the Capitol. And that was a bit challenging because, at least for phone calls, there were certain places in the Capitol you could get reception enough to have a phone call, but in certain offices where I could go into somebody's, you know, representative's office or whatever, somebody that I knew or knew the staff, and do something there. But there were also a few places that were out in the hallways you could get some reception, but there were a lot of places you really couldn't. And so that was a bit challenging. There were a lot of, texting was the biggest way of keeping in touch. And my phone, unfortunately, was one of those ones that didn't, like, hold an infinite number of texts. My phone still doesn't. I'm not even sure. I might still have the same phone. Maybe I've changed. I'm not sure. But I know there was one time relatively shortly after the occupation when a friend of mine is doing his dissertation on something related to the occupation, and he actually wanted, he was like, do you still have all those texts? Because there were so many texts back and forth for a meeting in this, you know, legislative office, and this is going on in the rotunda, and help, we have this thing happening over here, can you come now? And mm-hmm. just different things, and okay, something blah, 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 at the concourse at one, and then, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And so there was a whole lot of back and forth, and that was the biggest kind of way that my time was probably being, I don't know if organized is the right word, but at least pulled in different directions, was via text. And I ended up deleting those texts after the occupation because I needed space for more texts. And I just remember that friend of mine going, oh, you deleted all of those, really? And I was like, I didn't know I should keep them. I'm sorry. So, but that was, but I was doing my best anyway to kind of carry on what I was doing. And a bunch of that was moved to amend-related stuff. I mean, looking back at my planner, and I mean, remembering based on what was in my planner. I remember there was one steering committee call that I think I had that I managed to get on. I had a talk about a webinar I was given with another member of the leadership of Move to Amend. And I think I went to some place in the Capitol and kind of, you know, found a place I could have that talk. I was doing work on drafting that organizing toolkit, I think, more or less during this time. Although in the Capitol, there really wasn't a lot of downtime. It wasn't like... Even at the time, I was kind of thinking it'd be kind of amazing to keep a diary or something every day for reference, but honestly, there just was not time. Like, I didn't have time to sleep for the most part. It was just so much activity all the time, and you would try to get to sleep earlier, but there'd be things that you were dealing with or helping with or doing or whatever, and then you'd get to sleep late, and you get woken up in the night oftentimes by whatever, something happening, you know, that you needed to be there for, or somebody asking you to help fix something, or whatever the heck it was. And then, of course, sleeping on those marble floors wasn't the most restful anyway, and there was, you know, people would get going fairly early in the morning. So the whole time, there just wasn't a lot of time to sit around and, like, write things down, I guess, or to do my own work, although I did try. And I did a couple, I think, of radio interviews during that time, too. I think it was during that first part. Well, maybe it was in the latter part. I'm kind of a little blurry on that. Mostly, I just remember a whole lot of meetings, like constant meetings, during a large part of the occupation. Not the very, very early part, but like middle and then definitely like later as we moved into the lockdown period. It was just a lot of meetings of different kinds. And those were... I mean, there were some, like my union did have some general membership meetings. There were a couple of those. There was one that was held inside the Capitol. I forget which room it was in, but it was like the standing room only membership meeting in the Capitol that was fairly long, if I recall correctly. And I don't remember what was discussed. I'm sure it was something about, you know, the logistics of the occupation mm-hmm. or whatever, but and probably the legislative side of things. But honestly, I don't really remember that. But I do remember standing there and you know, participating in that. And that was somewhere... on or before February 18th, I know just because I've had a diary up that mentioned it. And then there was also another membership meeting for the TAA in the Concourse Hotel across the street. There was, again, on or after February 20th-ish. But the main thing I remember about that was being kind of surprised because a couple of, I mean, not good friends, but a couple of people that I knew that were friends of there was a guy that was dating long distance at the time, and these were a couple of his housemates that I'd met when I was in D.C., I don't know, a few months before, whenever it was. Taryn Kaufman, she has another hyphenated name, Taryn Kaufman, and Paul Adler. And anyway, they just, like, I walked in and they're sitting by the wall, and I was like, what are you guys doing here, you know, because it was a little out of place. And they're like, oh, we just came to Wisconsin for, I don't know, a couple of days or something. And so I was like, oh, cool, okay. So that was something that was interesting also, is there... I mean, there weren't a lot of people that were not from Wisconsin in the mix, but there were definitely some that, you know, there were a few people that I remember seeing who had traveled specifically to Wisconsin, and a couple that came to visit me, like Ben Branzel was a fellow that I was seeing at the time. He came out from D.C. for a few days later on, you know, to visit me, kind of, but it was, I think, mostly because there was this huge thing happening in Wisconsin, and they were all... these folks were all involved in kind of organizing in one way or another and were interested in, you know, seeing this firsthand and all that. I remember also, like, our union president, Randy Weingarten, showed up at some point, I think. But, I mean, that's not too surprising, right? So, anyway, so there were some, like, TA meetings. Another kind of set of meetings that were being held were what I think of in my mind, and I can't remember if it had a real name or not, was kind of a union, mostly like organized labor leadership group, or I don't know if leadership is the right word, but it basically reps from a number of the unions that would meet, and a handful of others who were from other organizations as well. And they would generally meet over at the Concourse Hotel, and I can't say exactly how often, but I feel like it was maybe every day or two. And so those meetings would happen, and I would go over, at least after the first. I think there were a few of them at the beginning were held I wasn't part of, and then anyway, at some point I started going to those. And we talk about whatever, like strategizing and various things. And let's see, then also there were these series of meetings inside the Capitol with what I would think of as the Capitol community, where mostly younger, non-union, non-officially affiliated, like, individuals, so a lot of younger folks, not only younger folks, but more younger folks, many of whom weren't actually a member of a union themselves, but were obviously there in solidarity and obviously cared very deeply about this. And so those meetings would happen in usually different legislative offices. And so the word would get around, hey, we've got a meeting in whatever, in an hour in such and such's office. And so we'd all kind of gather and somebody would chair it and we'd all discuss. And there was one of the dynamics that I remember, and I'm having trouble remembering exactly which part. I mean, this definitely happened throughout, kind of through to the, like, in the middle part of the occupation and then the lockdown period. There was still some of this, although it changed a little bit going on. The very, very early part, I don't think this was necessarily happening. But anyway, there was this Capitol community kind of group that would meet, and this union leaders group that would meet. And there were only a few people that were really going between the two and really belonged to both communities. I was one of those. Charity Schmidt, who is a TAA member, was one of those. Harriet Rowan as well, and Erica Wolf. And those are the main three people I remember. I remember also David Betcher was kind of in the union leaders group, and at one point did try to kind of come and make more of a link to the Capitol community group, but there were some trust issues for different reasons there. And I don't think that was David's fault, but it was just, there were these two kind of different cultures. And there was some, I think there were some trust issues between them for sure, with the folks over in the concourse not necessarily trusting that the folks in the Capitol crowd were really, you know, they were kind of this young, not so organized riffraff, I think was kind of the view. And so not necessarily, like, they weren't, I don't know, I feel like there was sort of a view of a status difference to some degree in terms of who was really, because nobody was really in charge, honestly. There were multiple kind of hubs that where people would connect, and there were different kind of groups that played different roles, but this idea that, oh, the unions were in charge of this, or such and such other group, no. Like, different groups were sort of in charge, different pieces of it, but nobody was really in charge, period. So there was this kind of dynamic anyway. And then the Capitol community, my recollection anyway, was that there was this feeling about, oh, well, those, like, official union people are over there meeting, and there's also this age difference and, you know, what have you, and a bit of a, like, racial ethnic difference, although that wasn't as marked, but perhaps a bit of that. And there was this sense of, those people, who do they think that they're, you know, they're making these decisions, but they're not the ones actually sleeping in the Capitol every night. They're off in their room in the concourse, and, we're the ones who are actually holding the space. So there was a bit of that. And I think that, I mean, obviously I can't speak for Charity and Erica and Harriet, although I would assume they would agree with this. I know I was kind of trying to diffuse some of that a little bit when I'd hear that kind of stuff. I'd say, well, you know, everybody is trying to do what we can. We're all kind of taking different pieces of this and would try to act as a go-between to, you know, kind of coordinate stuff where we could and to keep channels of communication open and, you know, keep the trust, you know, level high and all of that. And generally people were cooperative. I'm not saying that those two groups were like at war or anything. They were not. They were definitely on the same side and all. They were a little different in terms of demographics and how they saw their own role and how they saw their status versus, I think, the other group's status for different reasons. And so I think there was a little bit of discomfort kind of between the two of them maybe. And I'm not sure, you know, there very well may have been some other groups that other people would mention. I mean, I suspect there were multiple other kind of hubs where people were coming together that I was not a part of, right? Because this was this big very horizontally sort of, not or horizontally organized, I guess that's a correct way to say it, thing with the occupation. There were also a series, and this was mostly later on, as I recall, a few of them earlier too, but there were some later on during like the lockdown period, there were a number of like kind of logistical strategy meetings. And at that point, the folks who remained in the capital, I would call basically for the most part as part of this capital community crowd. There were some folks from the TAA who, some of us I would count in that kind of social grouping, some of them not. And a few folks from the union leaders group would kind of come and go. But for the most part, it was that kind of capital community group. I would say that, at least in my mind, that's how I would describe them. That were still in there during the lockdown period. And anyway, and then there were kind of subgroups of that that would go off and meet in different places because we were under this like constant surveillance or like, you know, video, you know, reporter, what do you call it? Media coverage. So we would go off and, you know, find different rooms or whatever to have other meetings where we could talk away from the video cameras and stuff. And a lot of those were things like strategy or, you know, like, well, what happens when they do kick us out? What's our exit strategy? You know, how are we going to hold the space now? What sorts of things do we need to do in the meantime to keep things going smoothly? I remember one conversation where there was this conversation about trying to get in supplies and the logistics of doing that. And there's this whole part of the conversation that was about how are we going to get water in, you know, and getting water in through windows and stuff like that. And I think that was pretty early in the lockdown period, I'm guessing, because I was just like, well, there are drinking fountains here, and so far they haven't shut off the water, so I don't think we need bottled water. Like, I just don't see why we need it. And people went, oh, yeah, I guess we don't. So then we talked more about, like, food and stuff like that. Yeah, and this is, like, after, I mean, because the TA kind of formed this other kind of hub, I would say, you know, this control room space earlier on, but that did get shut down, so the partway through, that was no longer really, at least, I mean, there were like a lot of TA members still around for sure, but it wasn't this single sort of space mm-hmm. anymore, I guess.
So just to clarify, so then after lockdown, and maybe because we don't know who's going to listen to this and the context with which they're going to listen to it.
Yes, right.
Could we take a second and talk about what that means?
Yeah.
And then I'll ask my follow-up question off of that.
Okay, sounds good. Yeah, and I've got kind of things, like I said, there's like the stuff that I tried to put down kind of a timeline, and I'm jumping around a little now just because a lot of these things kind of span different periods. Mm-hmm. And I've got more thoughts on the lockdown period that I'll get to at some point later. So when I say lockdown period, that is the period that started on February 27th, I think. It was a Sunday. Yeah, so the 27th, basically when we believed we were going to get kicked out of the Capitol by Walker and his people, and there's reasons for that I can talk about later. I mean, we thought that a few other times before, but this time we really, like, it seemed to like it was definitely going to happen. And we didn't end up getting kicked out in the end of it. They decided not to, but that night people were told, okay, well, actually, you can stay, you know, the night if you want to, but you can also, like, go home and come back in the morning. You know, the building will be open. We're not actually kicking you out. And so most people, there was this big gathering that Sunday where people were, like, ready to be arrested and just ready to stand the ground and stuff. And then when folks were told, hey, you know, go home, take a shower, whatever, come back tomorrow morning, a lot of people left. Not everybody. Some of us stayed. I stayed. But because I didn't believe them, honestly. So I stayed. But most people left. And so after that, on that Monday morning, when people came back, they were not allowed to come back in, for the most part. There was like a one-in, one-out policy for a while, but basically the number of protesters dropped a lot because people were locked outside. And there was this huge security apparatus set up with, I forget, metal detectors and whatever. But there were like police checkpoints, essentially, at like, or checkpoint, I think, at like the entrance where you could actually come into the building. And this caused all kinds of problems with legislators trying to keep a hearing, you know, open, and people not being able to get in to testify, and constituents not being able to get in. I think one legislator, an assembly person, I believe, even got, I forget if they got tackled or whatever, but I remember something about they were, you know, just coming in to do their own business, and like the security just accosted them. So there was this real police state feel to this thing in a lot of cops, you know, like more cops than protesters, I feel like it was, or at least it felt that way inside at that time. So that period from whenever, I guess, February, well, morning maybe of February 27th or night of February, no, sorry, morning of February 28th, I think, Monday or whatever, from about that period until the occupation actually ended, which was on March 3rd. When the last the people who were occupying the space left, that's what I'm referring to as the lockdown period. And I feel like that was what a lot of us were calling it at the time, although maybe there's other terms for it, but I think of it as the lockdown period. So
then, in that period, it sounds like it's a few days, maybe a week. There was
a few days, because February only goes for, I think it just has 28, well, unless it was 29, but yeah. So it was like, what, 3 or 4 days, I guess.
So then it was the Capitol community that you've been referring to wasn't just TAs, but it was sort of an eclectic mix.
Yeah, it's almost, I mean, on the one hand, like I guess I'm trying to explain how I classify different groups in my mind. Whether the individuals in some of those groups would agree with the classification I adopted, I don't know. You know, and there's a part of me that doesn't want to apply labels to other groups without knowing that that's what they would necessarily call themselves. At the same time, I don't know that there's any way to get those groups together completely at this point in time to really take a poll of everybody. So, but in my mind, I've kind of got different almost social groupings, or it's not just even social groupings. It's like almost a hub of, like a decision-making hub that involves certain types of people or certain people from different places, right? And so there was kind of the TA grouping that was especially early on quite active when we had that war room set up. When that went away, that kind of diffused, although the people were still there, but that kind of as a hub wasn't really a thing so much anymore. And then there was this union leadership group or whatever it was called that would meet over at the concourse usually. And not always at the concourse, but usually that was the case. And so there was that grouping. And then there was the Capitol community, which was really this more, you know, like the folks who actually were there and staying overnight, like all the time and really living there and really holding the space. And that was, in my mind, a different grouping. And of course, there's some fluidity between. So some of us did, I would say, belong to different groupings. And then there were some kind of subgroups out of that Capitol community that would take on specific logistical things, right? And I'm sure there were other, you know, there were other types of subgroups as well that I wasn't directly involved in. Like there were the marshals, right, who maybe they had their own internal structure, I don't know. There were some other conversations with some smaller groups that I was engaged with, several different groups actually, that were talking about different types of direct action. So we would kind of meet on a regular basis by going like upstairs to the third floor or whatever and finding a corner where there weren't any police, obviously within earshot, and then talking in hushed voices about, well, here's what we, you know, may make sense strategically or whatever. And there were other groups that would then have similar conversations in a much bigger like area, like down in the rotunda, I remember, like different kind of. So these different fluid sort of social groupings. And there was information flow between them, to some degree, but there were also a lot of conversations that were happening in multiple places at once that kind of resembled each other. And that was part of the kind of chaos of this. It was a chaos that worked. Like, it ended up working well, somehow. But there were these kind of different hubs, but things were kind of horizontally organized, or at least there wasn't a clear, you know, there wasn't really a hierarchical structure, right? I mean, there were some groups with individuals that I would say had more traditional social status for certain reasons, but it wasn't hierarchical in any real sense of the term. So,
Okay.
Is that...
Okay. All right, so I know you have other things you want to say. I didn't mean to...
Oh, no, that's totally
derail
okay.
...derail that, but maybe one other thing why we're talking about hubs here. You said there might be some, or you perceived perhaps some racial ethnic divisions between the group inside, if you will, and the labor leaders. Does that mean, or at least in your perception, does that mean the folks that were inside the Capitol were a more diverse group than the folks?
I would say that none of these groups were incredibly diverse. I mean, there tended to be a predominance of white, you know, middle class probably folks, right? But in terms of, I would say that the group in the Capitol was a bit more ethnic, racially, and ethnically diverse, at least that's my recollection, than the kind of union leadership group, which tended to be more, like, certainly older. That was the biggest thing. And then more, perhaps more white, more male, to some degree anyway. So there were some differences there, yeah. I think it was also a matter of just, I think the distress might have been less about like racial ethnic differences per se. I mean, maybe I'm wrong, but my sense was a lot of it came out of when you have folks that have societally recognized status, and then folks who feel like they're the ones actually doing quite a bit of the work and not necessarily getting the same kind of recognition or having the same resources, there can be some resentment that happens there, especially if there's a feeling that those folks are assuming their status makes their decisions more important. And I'm not saying that the union leadership or whatever group actually was necessarily thinking of it that way, but I think that some of the folks in the Capitol had that, some of that, the kind of perception that, oh, these people think that they're important. Yes, they're presidents of their locals and maybe the, some of the statewide unions or whatever, and but really, like, they don't even know what it is like to be here every day like we're doing. And we don't even really, like, know them personally because they just stay over there and don't, you know, interact with us, you know, on at least on a very regular basis. And so I think there was some of that just not necessarily understanding. And, I mean, frankly, there were reasons, I think, for that, too. Like, they were coordinating a lot on their side, a lot of them, with trying to get their members engaged, not just engaged, but a lot of members were already engaged, but trying to get people to the Capitol, trying to, you know, keep set up and keep political, you know, operations running, like phone banking to Republican senators who might, you know, districts of Republican senators, trying to get constituents to call in and urge them to vote against this bill and things like that. So there was lots of stuff happening, and there was plenty of stuff happening outside of the Capitol, too, where you had these different places where, like, I think the Labor Temple and certainly the TA office and probably some other places as well, I'm not sure, where there was plenty of volunteer, you know, organizing and effort going on up there, and that had to be coordinated and strategically directed and all of that. So it's not like, you know, those folks that were meeting in the Congress just went and met there and then went home and did nothing. It wasn't right. like that. But I just think it's a lot of times also easier to, I mean, most of us, I think, have a better understanding, certainly, of the stuff we're directly involved in. And it's easier to see the work you're doing than the work somebody else is doing when you don't really know what that is. Mm-hmm. Or even if you do see it, you know, I mean, like, if you have a housemaid and you each do half of the cleaning, right? Like, each of you thinks that you're doing more of the cleaning. Mm-hmm. Like, that's sort of human nature to some degree. So, you know, I think that given the situation, there was not, I don't think there was much, like, animosity or distrust given what it could have been, certainly. I think that for the most part things went quite smoothly, but was everybody 100% like, you know, just sunshine and rainbows 100% of the time towards everybody else and you know, identifying 100% as the same group? Well, no. I mean, this was a lot, large number of people, and there were some of the dynamics that you will see with when you get a bunch of people together, right? And I don't know, I found it really interesting how well it really did work, because I mean, I've been at some events and protests and things where you have this something, not to this degree, but a community that comes together and largely spontaneously organizes itself to meet needs as they arise, and kind of different people will end up in different kind of in different groupings or whatever to provide services of one kind or another to, say, protesters at an event or whatever. But I had never seen anything to this level where it was like a need would arise and somebody would just kind of step forward and say, okay, I can lead that. I can, you know, hey, we need childcare. I can help with that. Or, you know, the floors need to be cleaned, or we need to get people, you know, organized to quiet down the drums because such and such is happening. Okay, I can help with that. Or we need, you know, some kind of coordination information. We need somebody to talk to the police. I can do that. So there was this whole series of people just stepping forward and taking responsibility for pieces of it. You know, and there were pieces I did that for, and there were, you know, a lot of pieces that I certainly didn't, because, you know, I was already doing other things, but other people stepped forward and did, and it all kind of came together and worked in a, almost like, to me, a magical sort of way. I kind of, I was really surprised how well it really did work, and, you know, the stuff that I'm talking about in terms of some distrust, yeah, that was there, but, it wasn't, I don't think it was a huge thing compared to what you might think it would be. Like, yeah. People were generally really positive. But, you know, there were some currents of that, I would say. So.
Do you recall, as you were there, this is just from my own sort of curiosity, were people, people who were of the older generation who may have been in the Capitol, around the Capitol, comparing it to what was going on during the Vietnam era?
You know, I don't remember a lot of comments like that. I don't doubt that some people probably made them, but I don't remember that a whole lot.
Okay.
I remember a lot more comparisons to recent events, especially like what had been going on in Egypt and the Middle East. Those comparisons were definitely made.
Okay. I would say it's just something I've heard anecdotally. I just wondered if it happened.
I don't remember. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if I heard a few of those and just forgot. But it's not something that really sticks in my mind, no.
Mm-hmm.
No. I mean, they were definitely older and just, I mean, when I say like the Capitol community, there were some older, you know, individuals definitely in that group too. So it's not like it was all 100%
right.
Young folks or anything. Like, there were definitely some seasoned activists and, you know, older individuals who were, you know, in that grouping as well. So, yeah, but I don't remember that so much.
So, and then the other thing that you talked a lot about, being able to communicate via text message,
mm-hmm.
and also phone calls if you could find sort of the mm-hmm. right place. I'm wondering, at least again in your perception or your memory, what were other, or how effective were other social media or other types of electronic communication, you know, like Twitter, Facebook,
mm-hmm.
things like that?
I mean, Facebook was definitely, so the stuff that involved having to actually get on the internet, I don't have a smartphone, so for me, that would involve getting my computer out, which I had with me, and actually getting online that way. And at the beginning, like near the beginning of the occupation, I could do that. Later on, that became, you know, very difficult to impossible. So, well, I think there was, I'm trying to think. Yeah, we had, you know, we had like a media kind of publicity station set up during the lockdown period, but I don't think we had internet there. I think we had to take out, I'm not remembering exactly, but I feel like we might have had to take out like flash drives or something and like then have stuff uploaded outside of the building. I can't quite remember. But so for me, I mean, a lot of my attention was focused on organizing related stuff within the Capitol, and I wasn't so much trying to push that stuff out, although I did obviously write some diaries and get some stuff out. Like mm-hmm. at one point, after the lockdown started, I sent a text to a friend of mine who is also a Daily Kos contributor and has a larger following than I do, and said, hey, I'm still here if you want to interview me. I can't really get online to post anything. But so he ended up posting something there, and again, there were some other interviews. But yeah, for me, so I'm not much of a Twitter user either. I do have a Twitter account, which I think I actually created right around the time of the uprising, and I think I tweeted about 5 different things and then I haven't touched it since. But
mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I think Twitter was definitely being used by people, but I can't comment directly on it because I just am not much of a Twitter user.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, but for me personally, texting and calls were probably the main things, and then when I was able to get online, Facebook, to some degree, but for other people, I know that some of that other stuff played a bigger role.
Okay. So I think those are most of the... the one other follow-up question, guessing you would get to this, and so it may be something we'll talk about in the next, is we talked about the drum circle quite a bit, but I'm wondering about the rise of the what are now known as the solidarity singers.
Yeah, I wouldn't mind holding off.
Okay.
The rise I can't actually see a whole lot about, because I mean, like, I could tell you things about it, but it wouldn't be from direct experience, so it's probably not worth it, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I have actually been involved with that since the protests and during the crackdown there and that kind of thing, so I can talk about that later if you want.
Yep, that'd
be
great.
But yeah, the rise, that I wasn't really involved in that, so...
Okay.
Yeah.
So if you want to get back to wherever...
Okay. So let's see. I think I'm still in the sort of like somewhere in the early to middle period trying to explain what it was like. Let's see. I mentioned getting not very much sleep and there being a lot of meetings. There were a lot of little crises to solve. I probably already mentioned that, but... like, I remember, just things happening that would come up, and somebody or other would run up to you and say, oh, this is blah, 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 is going on, like, come now, or whatever. Or you'd get word of, hey, such and such are going to do a are planning to do this action or this thing, and maybe you might want to go and, you know, make sure, like, kind of be present for that discussion and, you know, whatever. So there was that kind of thing, which happened, I feel like, kind of a lot. I remember one time being woken up sleeping, I think after I'd just gotten to sleep and I was, like, exhausted, but I remember, like, being woken, like, shaken awake by, I think it was Taryn, yeah, it was Taryn and Paul, actually. It's about something, there was some group of kids, I shouldn't say kids, but young people who were planning, I guess we're talking about doing some direct action thing that seemed like it could go not so well and be disruptive or whatever, and I don't even remember what it was anymore, but they were like, oh, you should, you know, go, can you go in, because we're worried about this or whatever, so I kind of was like, oh, okay, and kind of got up and went over, and I don't even remember what it was, but I don't think they ended up doing anything then, so it ended up being okay anyway, but there was kind of that tension, I think, to some degree, because there were folks that wanted to do more radical stuff sooner, and other folks who were afraid that that would hurt, you know, the public image of the movement and didn't want to do that stuff, you know, unless it was really, well, either really necessary or certainly later on in the process or when it really got to that point. Like, they didn't want to escalate earlier, you know, wanted to hold off, which, and I would put myself more in that latter category. That's usually just how I think. But, I mean, there's very legitimate differences of opinion on that kind of thing. And so that was where some of these little mini crises were coming from, where different groups were getting impatient maybe with the pace of where things were going and were wanting to take stuff, you know, to the next level, and other people weren't really thinking that was a good idea yet. And there wasn't any certainly formal decision-making structure, right? There wasn't a hierarchical structure. It's not like you could go to the president of the occupation and, like, propose an idea. It just didn't work that way. And so you had these kind of almost this bubbling up of different you know, ideas and plans and things in different places, and you'd oftentimes hear secondhand about it, and then, you know, if you wanted to, you could go and find out more potentially. And some stuff I'm sure, you know, I'm sure there's lots of stuff I never heard about, right, as well. I mean, there must have been.
So on that note, I'm going to jump in.
Okay.
Because there was another thing I wanted to ask, and I think you alluded to it or maybe even mentioned it in the last interview, but the idea of a general strike.
Yeah.
I'm wondering how much you remember hearing about that and how much it sort of registered for you as being something that could actually happen.
Oh, yeah, I remember hearing a lot about that. I mean, a lot of just conversations, informal conversations. A lot of people were talking about this. I mean, our local labor council here also voted to endorse that, the South Central Federation of Labor at one point. I mean, there were different unions that were, like, you know, locals that were in favor. And that was being discussed in that union leaders group as well, as I recall. I mean, I feel like it was being discussed more or less everywhere. In terms of how likely, I mean, I thought that it was something that would, it would be a really big step if we did it. I mean, I was in favor of it, frankly. I thought that we should do it because I felt like that if, you know, if this thing was going to keep going forward, that we should end up, you know, in time anyway, using all the tools that we had reasonably available to us. And that, I think, is a tool that, personally, I think we should have used. But obviously there were people definitely who were very reticent about the idea as well. But I think for the most part, at least among the people that I was talking to, there was general support for the idea of a general strike. And a lot of us, I mean, at least I thought it was possible. I would say I probably put myself as, like, in terms of, is it a good idea? Yes, probably, you know, when the right time comes, it makes sense to me. How likely is it to happen? I probably would have put it at, like, under 50% chance, but certainly over 25. So something like that, like 40 or something, where I thought it was a distinct possibility, but I wasn't convinced it was going to happen just because of the risks that were entailed and the tendency of, and that was already apparent fairly early on, for leadership, I would say, of a number of the unions and whatever, to be clearly looking for other ways of dealing with things, not wanting to call for a strike, not wanting to appear that radical or to make that big an ask of their members or of, you know, other workers in the area. And, yeah, and obviously it didn't end up happening. But there was a lot of discussion of it, though, from pretty much just about the beginning of the whole period, honestly. Like, it was something that came up right away, more or less.
Okay.
Yeah.
One other thing for this time at least, and that's, you talked about sort of a a duh moment when there was a discussion about where to get water. Mm-hmm. There's a water fountain.
Yeah.
But food was an issue.
Food was more of an issue.
And, you know, I've heard from people and heard anecdotally that, you know, that Ian's Pizza was a place that, for lack of a better word in my mind right now, sort of was a godsend for a lot of people.
But luckily, it's actually good pizza. So, like, to this day, I can still eat Ian's Pizza without... I mean, I like it. It's good.
But I wonder if whether or not you want to...
Certain other pizzas that I had to eat too many of in union meetings.
Right. So, you know, whether or not you want to talk about specifics, but if you wouldn't mind talking a little bit about the idea of the logistics of trying to feed people.
Well, yeah, and I wasn't the one coordinating that. So, again, people stepped up to take on different pieces, and I was not, you know, the one leading the food or any of the pieces of the food effort. I mean, early on, when the TAA had its war room, that was a hub where people would bring food, and there was a table set up outside where you could put like fruit and vegetables and crock pots and bread and whatever people had, right, and utensils and all the rest. Obviously, at one point that went away, and then there were, I'm trying to remember, I mean, there were, I can't remember if there was just one, I feel like there was a plural of kind of food places, food stations or something that would kind of happen at different times. Like, I remember at the evening of the lockdown, we all got a ton of pizza, like 300 boxes or something of pizza. Like, I have a photo of it. And they just basically set up in this one place on the ground floor and just served pizza from there, right? But at different points in time, there would be sort of these, like, pizza would show up usually somewhere near the rotunda, and then word would get around, hey, there's pizza, and you'd go over there and get food or whatever. And there was other food that also would come, like after the GMM, the general membership meeting that the TA held in the Capitol, that, you know, fairly early on, I remember somebody coming around with, like, I think it was just food and water, but, you know, and offering that. And there were a bunch of local businesses that were donating food, also things like bagels and that kind of thing. I mean, I remember more than the exact food, because that all kind of blurs together a little bit, was, like, we had a list, I remember, up on the wall of, at one point, of all the different businesses that had donated food, and, like, you know, had a list up there, like, thank you to our local businesses for supporting the protest or whatever, and quite a long list of local restaurants and what have you that had brought in food and donated food. And then Ian's was taking orders from, well, across the world, really, like, we were getting pizza from Egypt and Europe and like all kinds of different places, which was cool. And I mean, in some of my, you know, when I was talking to other folks via Facebook or I think maybe some of the blog posts I put up, I can't remember, had this in there. You know, I'd ask, hey, you know, if you can, you can donate to, well, Defend Wisconsin, which is a website that the TAA in part set up, but which I can talk about more later. Or, you know, also you can order food, like, you know, pizza or whatever. So these were some ways that people could contribute to the uprising, even if they were nowhere near to it geographically. There was also a phone banking system we had set up that you could phone bank. And I didn't set that up, but I remember trying to direct people to it, where you could phone bank from anywhere into some of these legislators' districts that we were trying to get, you know. I think early on, maybe it was actually to get them to vote against the bill, or maybe it was about trying to find people to sign the recall petitions. Like, actually, I can't quite remember what it was, but I remember getting, like, that there was some phone banking system set up for the people, like, if you were in, you know, like, Utah or Florida or something, you could call in. But yeah, pizza, I mean, the pizza thing was definitely big. There was a lot of pizza. And, of course, people got pretty creative with the pizza boxes, too, like the lids. There were a lot of, there was a whole section downstairs in, like, the rotunda area, just with all these pizza boxes stacked up with different, like, messages written on the different kinds, right? And there's photos out there of that. There's some pretty creative ones. So that was cool. I mean, I think that level of kind of the creativity and humor side of it is one of those things that's so important. And, I mean, it happened organically. It's not like, I don't think anybody was like, we must introduce humor into this dismal situation. But I have to say, I think it really is so important in a situation like this, because you're under a lot of stress and you're fighting something that's frankly really terrible, and you're making some personal sacrifices to be there probably. And the positive part of that, I mean, certainly the feeling of community and just being part of something larger, which there was definitely very much that feeling. It wasn't, I mean, I think there was don't know, there was very much that feeling. And then the humor, that kind of seeing what everybody else wrote on the pizza boxes and taking a few minutes to go and read the latest editions of, you know, that collection or whatever, would give you a few laughs. And I think that was really important. I don't know. And I feel like some larger campaigns, but other, I mean, this was a different type of event, right? This was it was an uprising. It was a lot of people coming together fairly organically and interacting with each other face to face in different ways. Some other political types of or issue campaigns, I think, sometimes forget that, the importance of that kind of human side or that humor and kind of creativity side a little bit. When, you know, you'll make these calls like, "Oh, something's this horrible thing is happening. Call your legislator. Do this. Do this." Like, the sky is falling, and the sky may very well be falling, but at the same time, you kind of need that positivity there, and that, you know, you need to be able to hope, certainly, but you also, something to break that up and make you actually, you know, feel like there's a some kind of positive element to the struggle, and that it's not just all drudgery, is really important. And the pizza thing was, and I'm really, like I said, I'm really glad Ian's makes good pizza, because, I mean, there was a lot of pizza. Yeah, so.
All right, so that's the end of my sort of asides here. And we're at 50 minutes, so we have, you know, I have like 10, 15 minutes.
That's about what I've got, too. Yeah, okay. I probably need to leave in like 15 minutes at the latest.
All right.
Okay. Yeah, I guess another thing I'd say is just that there was this really timeless feeling inside the Capitol where, I mean, the whole occupation was like, what, like 2 or 2.5 weeks? 2.5 weeks, is that right? But I remember during it just feeling like it was years. Like, it just, and you really couldn't tell easily what time of day it was. I mean, it got louder at certain points of the day, but the way that the Capitol is, there's some windows way up in the top, but you can't really see, you don't get a good signal of the time of day based on the light. It's all kind of dim all the time, like, but not dark. And it was this echoey kind of, you know, this echoey sort of, environment where, especially when it wasn't like the middle of the night, it just, you can hear this kind of dull, echoey background noise all the time, and it was kind of just always there, and there was just kind of somewhat dim atmosphere, and it was kind of always there, and it was really, and I mean, at least for me, there were so many meetings that I felt like I was jumping between meetings and doing this and that and trying to, you know, organize this and trying to fix this crisis and whatever, and so it was just constantly moving too, and it all just really ran together. I mean, it ran together, so I mean, it's hard to tell the days apart, but the days also stretched out to, like, eternities, where it really didn't feel like 2.5 weeks. It felt like, you know, like I said, it felt like years. It just felt like this interminable amount of time that we were living in the Capitol, even though now, looking back, there were things that happened within days of each other where it's like, oh, that happened that soon, really? Mm-hmm. But it's, like, almost, it's just incredible that actually, that was really the timeline, because inside, the sense of time was totally warped. And that's one of the reasons also it's hard to kind of put things in order a little, because it's like the time in there just didn't even match up to the time outside, you know? Mm-hmm. There was one thing that happened also, and I can't put a date on this, although maybe you know when this happened. I actually wouldn't mind knowing if you know, because I don't know. But there was a time relatively early on, I think, and it might have been like a week into the occupation, or maybe it wasn't that far, I'm not sure. So we'd been hearing these rumors, I think I mentioned this before, there had been rumors on a fairly regular basis of, oh, tonight's the night we're going to be kicked out, or tonight's the night this or that will happen. And so to some degree you'd gotten to this point where, you know, you kind of didn't take the rumors all that seriously because you'd heard them before, but then you kind of were worried about them anyway because you figured some of this stuff would happen at some point. And there was one day that I remember there had been rumors, like, swirling around that tonight's the night we're going to get kicked out and there would be this crackdown. And, you know, we were kind of on guard and on edge, or we, at least I was, and a number of other people were. And then it got late enough that we were all kind of bedding down and nothing had happened. And we thought, okay, well, maybe tonight's not the night, although maybe. And then fairly late at night, and I don't remember what time exactly, maybe it was like midnight or 1 or something like that, I remember that they started tearing down our, like, the signs on the walls and the railing and stuff. Like, there were, you know, state troopers and cops anyways tearing down these signs. And everybody kind of jumped up and ran in there and were like, what are you doing? You know, like, what's happening with this? And just this, I mean, there's this, like, really near kind of almost confrontation. I feel like there were, tensions were pretty high. And I'm trying to remember. See, another thing I can't remember was if we had had some assurance that it might have been a matter of, like, that we were supposed to put the signs up with blue tape, which I think was a request. I don't remember if that was the Capitol Police or who, but and that we'd done that and that they were tearing them down saying that couldn't be there. I forget what it was. But there was some kind of feeling of, like, why are you doing this? This isn't what you're supposed to be doing. And anyhow, so there was this kind of almost confrontation thing. And some of the, I think it was some of the Madison, like the Capitol Police, I believe. I remember kind of being a little group that kind of gathered around one, maybe two officers, I forget, and we're trying to figure out what was going on. And they were, I mean, I don't remember exactly how the conversation went, but I remember that, in the end, there were a couple things. That one was that it did not actually seem to be the case that Chief Tubbs had ordered this. This had come from somewhere else. That was part of it. So there were these orders that were, you know, originated from somewhere that it was time to take all these signs down. And that was probably the rumors that we'd heard earlier, like kind of through the grapevine telephone, you know, telephone game kind of thing, where they had changed from that into, you know, kicking the protesters out or something. I'm not sure. But there was that. So it didn't seem to have come from him. And then there was also this sense of, like, well, you know, we don't really know what you guys, like the protesters, are doing, like we, the police, and there hasn't been much communication. You know, and so that was the night that I remember standing around with whoever that, I don't remember which police officer or officers that was. It was like one or two, I think. And standing around with, like, Charity, and I think Harriet, and I believe Harriet and Erica and Charity were all there. At least Charity, I'm sure, was. And basically, somebody was like, well, you know, we should probably, like, have somebody that can be in regular communication with you guys to try to keep things, so we both know what's going on the other side, and we can kind of keep things as calm as possible and work, you know, together where we can or whatever it was. And kind of looked around like, well, who's willing to do this? And Charity, I remember she stepped forward, and, I mean, Harriet and Erica also did, although, like, it would be good to talk to them because the details of that particular conversation are a little hazy. But my recollection was that we were all there and they all stepped forward, but it might have been just Charity and Harriet, and I don't know. But anyway, that was kind of the evening that that police liaison team, which is what they ended up being, basically, formed. We didn't call it that. At least I didn't. I wasn't, in my mind, I didn't label it as a police liaison team, but that is what they were. And they would have, they would meet then with Chief Tubbs on a relatively regular basis. And I was involved in, I think it was just one meeting at the very end of that process. So there was one meeting that I was also present for, but I was not part of, you know, the group that was meeting regularly. It was the three of them mainly. But yeah, that was a kind of a scary moment because, you know, you kind of, I think I was already asleep, although maybe I'm misremembering that, but where suddenly there was this commotion and there's these state troopers just ripping down these signs. There's people yelling and, you know, like, just like, oh my goodness, what's going to happen? Mm-hmm. And then it did manage to get resolved in a way that, you know, actually ended up being positive, because then we had this communication channel set up and there was an opportunity for more conversation and more respect. And I mean, Chief Tubbs was, very professional and helpful in general. And I mean, he was in a really tough position during the whole occupation. Like, he had a tough job, but he did that job in a way that was very, I would say, very, a positive and very balanced kind of a way, in a very mature, responsible way. Much more so than police chiefs in a lot of, you know, situations that involve protesters and, you know, things like that. So he really is to be commended, I think, for his the job that he did. And meeting with, you know, some of our folks on a regular basis was, I think, part of that. Let's see. So that takes up to about February, I don't know. Hard to say exactly, but so let's see. So February 17th is when the senators left, right? So just me personally, my friend, the fellow I was seeing then, arrived on February 20th, and you left on February 3rd, 23rd, I actually know that because I found an email or something. But he also, his background is mostly in online organizing. Like, he used to work for Move On, and he continues to do that kind of stuff now. So this was, I think this stuff was very different for even those of us who do a lot of on-the-ground community organizing, but I think, you know, for him it was like, whoa, this is, like, amazing and totally different than anything I've seen before. So he was there for a few days and stayed in the Capitol and helped with various things. I mean, I think he was, you know, putting up his own, I forget what, blog post or something, whatever he was doing during the time. I remember that he was, I guess the TA war room was still going on at this point because I have photos of him in the war room using the internet there. So, but at one point he actually sprained his ankle running down the stairs in one part of the Capitol to pass out nonviolence training flyers for me, and so he ended up spraining his ankle. I ran across the street to Walgreens and got him some crutches, but he got treated at the medic station that had been set up there, which was one of those hubs I think I mentioned, that the medic station was definitely one of them, and he was just like super impressed by that. He just kept going on about the medic station and how amazing it was. It just, like, people had brought it together and that he got, like, great care there and they just really knew what they were doing. And he was just very impressed by how professional they were, I think. So, and unfortunately, he was then on crutches for the rest of the time. But, I mean, he took it well, I think. Let's see. So that was... I think you asked about the... Well, no, you asked about general strike, but the recall conversations were another thing that were kind of ongoing. Mm-hmm. And I know those started happening really early on. I know I have a note in my planner from Monday, February 21st, to talk about them to Scott Spector, who worked for AFT, which to me, I think, if I recall correctly, was a matter of, like, they'd gotten to a point that I was, concerned that, there were people that ended up taking the lead on those, and it wasn't me, but... And I was a little concerned about things getting ahead of themselves and that I wanted to make sure that, there's some preparation was actually going on over on the AFT side by then and or whatever Scott was connected to besides that. And, I think it was. Because the recall thing, even to this day, there's quite a lot of folks that I've heard say things like, well, if the unions haven't, insisted on trying to recall these people, then we would have had this uprising continue and this popular movement continue, but they usurped it. And, I've heard people say things like that, which is totally not how it happened. The recall, especially the recall of Walker, although the recall of various senators and stuff was in the mix too, but the Walker recall was getting discussed from the beginning, and it was very clear that people... just regular, everyday people that weren't in any kind of leadership position with unions were going to go ahead and just start collecting signatures, and already, well before the period when they could, were already collecting basically commitments from people to sign the petition once it was possible to do so. And so this train was leaving the station regardless. It wasn't something that the union leadership decided. They could have decided to totally sit it out, but then you probably just would have had a less effective recall petition, so that wasn't really an option either. They did a lot of work on that, certainly, but this the idea that sometimes gets repeated that, the union leadership was the one, they're the ones that really led the recall effort. It's like, well, yes and no. Like, they weren't the ones that instigated it. It was already going to happen regardless. It was happening regardless, and they kind of had to, jump on board to some degree so that there was a well-orchestrated campaign during the 60-day window allowed to collect signatures, as opposed to like several different disjointed efforts that may or may not even get to the signature goal and certainly wouldn't get as many signatures as you would want to get, which would be worse probably than you wouldn't want it to fail and look like a failure, because then that could also have negative repercussions. But there were definitely a lot of conversations about recall from pretty early on. During that period, I was also like still leaving. I know there were some meetings in my planner that I had to leave the Capitol to chair. This was before the lockdown period started. Maybe I can actually just make it to lockdown period and we can then wrap up, I don't know. Mm-hmm. Okay. So, yeah, and more, meetings with, again, I mentioned different people coming in from like the AFT Wisconsin president at one point showed up, and at one point I have in my planner that I left the Capitol for some meeting with Medea Benjamin, I remember, and I don't remember what, she's with Code Pink, and I don't remember what came of that, but there were some miscellaneous things like that where we'd still, you know, felt like we could leave the Capitol and come back and reliably get in, and didn't really realize how nice that was until we lost that ability. So let's see. February, sorry, I'm like looking at my notes. February 25th, meeting February 26th, Saturday. Okay, there's another meeting I had to chair that day on the west side. So I left for a portion of that day to chair that, and then I came back. Okay, so Sunday, February 27th. So that was the day that that ended with the crackdown and then the subsequent lockdown. So I'm wondering whether it would be better to stop here and start there the next time.
Yeah, I mean, we're at
105. Because we're pretty much at time.
Yeah, we're at 105.
Okay. Let's do that then.
So we'll start at February 27th.
Okay.
All right, so this concludes this oral history. Thank you, Kai, for your time. I appreciate it.